Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a moment, deepening dialogue with the Russian Orthodox Church. We hear from the president of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity. World Water Day, a United Nations initiative aimed at providing clean, safe drinking water for all. And Catholic-Muslim relations. We take a closer look with the former official in charge of Islam at the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. Deepening the dialogue with the Orthodox Church. That was the aim of a visit to Moscow earlier this month by the Vatican's top ecumenist, Swiss Cardinal Kurt Koch. The Cardinal, who is president of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity, travelled to Moscow on March the 12th for a five-day visit that included talks with Russian Orthodox leaders and a meeting with the small Catholic community there. It was his first meeting with the Russian Orthodox Patriarch Kirill, and on his return, the Cardinal told me the two churches must find ways of deepening their dialogue and working together to defend Christian values that are under threat in contemporary society. Cardinal Koch, you're just back from this first meeting with Patriarch Kirill. What can you tell us about progress in the relationship with the Russian Orthodox Church?
That's my first visit at Moscow and the first meeting with His Holiness the Patriarch. That was a very kind meeting, very open. We have talked about the general situation of the ecumenism in the world and why we can deepen the dialogue between the Catholic Church and the Russian Orthodox Church.
You spoke about the need for joint witness to Christian values, didn't you? What do you mean by this? What kind of concrete initiatives, perhaps, would you like to see?
That's the vision of His Eminence, the Metropolitan Hilarion, and strategic alliance with the Catholic Church, but also with Protestant Church, for witness the very important values of the Christianism. I think that the term is a little difficult, because in the West that has a militarian connection, connotation, and we must, I think, find a new name, but not a new project. The project is important. I think that we can find a very good way for together we gave witness in the world of the fundamental values in Europe.
Did you discuss any particular concrete ideas for furthering this cooperation?
I think that in the first line is to demonstrate, to witness the value of the family, and the second, the dignity of the life from the beginning to the natural end, and in the third line, the freedom of religion in the world. I think that are three values that are very, very in danger in our societies.
The dialogue with the Russian Orthodox Church there is complicated, isn't it, by the difficult relationship between Moscow and the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, as we saw again during their recent inter-Orthodox meeting in Switzerland. Can the Catholic Church play any role? Can you help in any way to ease these tensions, do you think?
When the Patriarchate of Moscow and the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople want that we help, we will help. But that's not our office to take an initiative for this. But I think we can help just in the International Mixed Commission for the Theological Dialogue between the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church to find a way for a human witness in the Orthodox churches. That's the same difficulty that we have in the Catholic Church. We have many tensions and very, very different ways, and that's in first line is absolutely necessary in Catholic ecumenism. And I think that's our first office to do.
You're meeting again with Metropolitan Hilarion twice this month, aren't you, in different occasions. Would you say that the dialogue with the Orthodox world is a top priority for you?
Next Friday, we met us in Fribourg because Metropolit Hilarion became a titular professor of Fribourg, and I find that's a very, very important sign of the church and the state of the canton Fribourg to accept an Orthodox metropolitan as professor.
Would you say that this is a top priority for you, the relationship, this particular relationship now?
No, I have two priorities. The first priority is the dialogue with the Orthodox churches and the Oriental churches. But on the other way, the dialogue with the world of the churches and ecclesial communities come from the Reformation.
The Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church is electing a new head this week. What do you hope from that?
It's for me very difficult to say something concrete because I don't know very well the situation in the Ukraine. I think that the next priority for me must be to go personally to the Ukraine, foresee the situation and what we can help. Then I hope that we have a new head. He is open for the situation, the ecumenical situation in the Ukraine, that not is very, very easy.
I know you're also talking about Christian unity and faith in Europe, aren't you, at your next meeting. Would you like to say something about what you'll be saying in that context?
I have a little conference about the importance of the theological dimension of the ecumenical dialogue, because today many people say the theology cannot resolve this problem. We must resolve in the basis. And I think to remember that the questions between our churches have an ecclesiological and theological dimension, and we must deepen this dimension.
Do you think there's an increasing sense that people will not take seriously the Christian message unless the churches can resolve these theological differences and find a stronger, more common voice?
I think I feel some feeling of resignation in the ecumenical situation, and we must find new ways in the future, but this is impossible without a theological dialogue. In the ecumenical dialogue with the Orthodox Church, we make always a difference between the dialogue of truth and the dialogue of love. And both dialogues are very, very important. Without the dialogue of love, we cannot begin a dialogue with truth. But without the dialogue of truth, that's a not easy kind of love.
My thanks there to Cardinal Kurt Koch, President of the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity. March 22nd is marked in countries around the globe as World Water Day, an initiative aimed this year at focusing attention on the impact of rapid urban population growth and other problems caused by climate change, conflict, and natural disasters on urban water systems. The UN observance aims to encourage governments, organisations, communities and individuals to actively engage in addressing the challenge of urban water management. It's an area in which Catholic aid and development organisations are also very much involved, and Pope Benedict himself has repeatedly spoken out about the inalienable rights of people to clean, safe drinking water. Tragically, though, thousands of children die every single day from a lack of clean water and correct sanitation, a problem which UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, is struggling to combat in many of the poorest countries of the world.
Yes, we know that 1/6 of all the deaths of children under age 5 are due to pollution of water.
Donata Lodi is in charge of international relations and advocacy with UNICEF here in Italy. She spoke to Vatican Radio's Luca Attanasio about the problem and about some very simple yet highly effective solutions.
Water that is contaminated by many different sources, but basically water that is not drinkable. And that causes a vicious circle of diarrhea that combined with malnutrition and various infectious illnesses creates death for children. So we have 1.5 million children that die every year just because they don't have access to safe water supplies.
Very often we hear projects to build up wells to tackle the problem of water scarcity, but there is a bigger problem sometimes, which is sewers.
Yes, the problem of sanitation, the lack of sanitation is even worse than the lack of water, especially in developing countries, especially in the most remote and isolated regions of developing countries. And it causes a lot of troubles for the local population. Lacking sanitation, lacking sewage, but also lacking basic sanitation, which is just toilets, safe toilets, means that even the wells that are excavated can be contaminated in the span of a few years. So it means it's like a Sisyphus work. You have to rebuild and create new wells to move away from the area that is contaminated by what should be in the sewage. And if the sewage don't exist, even the human remnants are contaminating the wells. This means that we have to work together. Water and sanitation. And there is a lot that has to be done with local communities in terms of hygiene education, teaching how important it is to use proper toilets that can be built at a very low cost by the local population themselves. And even for wells, it's important to involve the communities in this process. If they are part of it, they will preserve what is being created and they will know in the future how to manage this very scarce resource.
Can you tell us something about the initiative World Day of Hand Washing?
This is a new initiative that UNICEF developed starting in Southern Asia, mainly in India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, but it has now evolved in a World Day that is celebrated every year to create a commitment in the local communities of the importance of hygiene, of washing hands properly, and it is a real success. We are surprised ourselves by the result that we are getting out of it, especially children in the schools. They are mobilizing themselves. They are learning how to properly wash hands, and they are teaching their own families and spreading the voice. So it's a sort of movement that is being created on the importance of proper hygiene behavior. It's a very basic behavior, washing hands properly with water and soap. But it can be the start of a new trend in hygiene education, starting from the community themselves and from children themselves.
Let's finish with some good news.
Well, we have plenty of good news. It may sound strange in a period of time where all the development cooperation is being cut by the major donors government, but we have a very positive trend in the reduction of children mortality. We had a reduction of 30% in the span of 30 years, and we could achieve the results that the international community has put with the Millennium Development Goals if only we had a little bit more of money to be used for basic things like providing safe water, educating communities, doing the kind of work at the grassroots level with communities which is essential. We can reduce the children's mortality, we can reduce the unacceptable toll of 22,000 children dying every single day because of very simple illnesses like diarrhea, like lack of water, like lack of basic health systems.
I am really optimistic because the resources there, we need to manage it better.
Stephanie Neno works with UNESCO's World Water Assessment Programme. She told Luca Attanasio why UNESCO is so concerned with the problem of water worldwide.
This is interesting because UNESCO, the S in the acronym stands for science. So UNESCO has a big water science department, actually, and they have this IHP program, which is the International Hydrological Program, based in Paris, and WAP, which is the other program on water, the World Water Assessment Program, based in Perugia. So in reality, UNESCO is pretty active on water issues and has been for a while.
Can you tell us some of the main projects that UNESCO runs?
The IHP program is interested in groundwater and all, basically water resources, assessing water resources, managing water resources, but also urban water, water management globally. While the World Water Assessment Program, the one based in Perugia, we addressed water assessment, water use and water management in the world.
The best way to tackle the water issue is, as you said, to have an intersectoral approach. Will you explain us a bit about what you mean by the water box?
Yeah, so the water box is what we usually call the water sector. So it would be providing basically access to water and possibly sanitation services. While water is not only this, it's not only providing water for people, it's the managing the water resource, it's ensuring its management, its sustainable management, it's ensuring that the different sectors that need water for their existence are informed about the status of water, the current status of water, about the different pressures, the drivers, we call them drivers, that are on water, so that they don't take decisions in their own box. So not only the water box, but each sector could be considered as a box, and it's not a good approach. All the sectors should be working together, sharing information, and trying to make decisions that are sustainable for them and for the others.
Since the beginning of the world, water has always been a solution for many problems. But unfortunately, as we see, water has become a problem, big problem in many situations. What do you think can be done?
I don't consider water as a problem. Even when we talk about conflicts, water conflicts, it has been proved that water is more often a source of cohabitation and cooperation rather than conflict. So you have also a few wrong ideas around water. I am really optimistic because the resources there, we need to manage it better. We need to have more information about water in order to manage it better. And we need to involve all the sectors, as I said, all the decision makers, but also all the people, the public at large, the media, to communicate rightly about water.
Thanks there to Stephanie Neno from UNESCO, and earlier you heard Donata Lodi from UNICEF Italy speaking to Vatican Radio's Luca Attanasio. I was quite struck recently by some headlines in an English Catholic paper suggesting that dialogue with the Muslim world has come to a dead end and that not much has been achieved in the four decades since the Second Vatican Council radically reshaped the Church's attitude to people of other faiths. In view of the 25th anniversary of Pope John Paul's famous Day of Prayer for Peace in Assisi on October 27, 1986, I decided to look closer at the state of Catholic-Muslim relations with someone who's dedicated his life to furthering interfaith understanding, despite the problems and polarization, which can be seen by some as an insurmountable obstacle.
think that what we're going through today is a kind of polarization. People are really much more ready to defend their own position in their own group.
Jesuit Father Tom Michel was the former official in charge of Islam at the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, as well as serving as the Jesuit Secretary for Interreligious Dialogue and the Ecumenical Secretary for the Federation of Asian Bishops' Conferences. He's worked and lectured in countries across the world and is currently teaching at a number of Turkish universities.
It's more difficult getting people to see and act inclusively. I get more opposition when I say something basic, a Vatican II statement like, God loves all people and wants all people to be saved. People say, well, how can you say that? Well, Vatican II said it quite clearly. Or you mentioned that Muslims and Christians worship the one and the same God. And people say, oh, you can't say that. Well, John Paul II said it frequently. The Second Vatican Council said one of the reasons why we have respect and should have esteem for Muslims is that they worship the one God. So things that back in the 60s could be said without somebody coming up and calling you on it, now I think is more difficult. Certainly, the geopolitical situation has not helped, and I think that's probably what's really at the basis of all of it, of all the theological problems that we have between Christians and Muslims. You do have a real perception in the United States and in Western Europe that Muslims are a threat. Sometimes people talk about Islam in a kind of disembodied way as though it were a threat. On the other hand, Muslims say, well, ours are the countries that are getting destroyed. Ours are the people who are getting killed. And they point to Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I think there's a mutual feeling of we are at danger from the other group. And that makes negative feelings. And, of course, every time these negative feelings are acted out in a violent way, then the other side gets more rooted in their negative feelings and feelings of being threatened.
Let's look at the situation in the Maghreb and Middle East today, these pro-democracy movements. Would you like to see the church speaking out more strongly in defence of the civilian populations who are at risk at the moment?
Well, of course, the church's role is to speak in the name of those who can't speak for themselves, whether they be Christians or whether they be Muslims or whoever. The church has this obligation to speak out in favor of those who are getting oppressed, who are getting wronged, who are getting bombed and killed. And once again, it's a prudential decision. I think maybe here I would have liked to have seen us say, speak more clearly and more strongly. I think the church, since it's not a military institution, but a moral one, I think can act more quickly in such situations by making moral statements.
What do you think is likely to be the long-term effect of particularly the small Christian communities in these countries like Egypt, like Tunisia, like Libya?
Well, the only one of those three that really has a sizable Christian community is Egypt, or you, we might say an indigenous Christian community. The hope, of course, is that they'll get a government, which by necessity is going to be made up of Muslims, a government that is respectful and respects the rights of the minorities, of the Christian minority. What we want for the Christians in Egypt is the same as what we want for Muslim minorities in France or America or Australia. We want their civil rights, their religious rights, respected and upheld. I think in today's world it's becoming more and more clear that one of the marks of responsible government that we look for is how that government treats the minorities, whether they be ethnic minorities, religious minorities, linguistic minorities. If they respect the minorities, if they try to hear their voice, if they try to listen to their needs and respond to these things, we say this is a responsible government.
The question of religious freedom has become a very high-profile concern, hasn't it? If we look at, for example, Pope Benedict's most recent Peace Day message, often this means highlighting cases where Christians are victims, not always, but often of Muslim violence. it's clearly important to speak out and defend the rights of these people, but how does this affect overall the dialogue, do you think? What effect has this had?
Well, I think so long as we are even-handed and not only defending Christians who are persecuted or who are wronged or oppressed, and not seen as being just another partisan group sticking up for its own rights, but if we're seen as being fair-minded, if we're seen as being in favor of also Muslims when they're being wronged, then I think the vast majority of Muslims who are fair-minded will see that. So I think the important thing is, how do you develop and maintain a level of trust in which you can speak to one another without it seeming like an attack or a judgmental view towards the other?
What are the most important elements in maintaining that trust that you're talking about?
One thing is being very careful about what we say about each other, being ready to admit our mistakes, being self-critical as well as critical, and being just as self-critical as we are critical, being ready to ask forgiveness when we do make a mistake, because everybody does. I think these things are what you need to do to maintain that level of trust before we can really do any kind of cooperation, before we can do any kind of discussion, before we can begin to really understand what each other is saying. The direction that we should be going in dialogue has already been clearly set out by Nostra Aetate in the Second Vatican Council, in which they say, the bishops said, even though there have been many quarrels and dissensions between Christians and Muslims down through the centuries, very true, we ask both communities to move beyond the past, to work together for the common good, and it gives four key areas in which we should be working together with Muslims: that of peace, working together for justice, working together to defend moral values, and working together for true human freedom. These four key areas are very important. It's a kind of common mission that we have with Muslims in today's world.
What gives you most hope in that dialogue? You've followed it so closely over the years.
Well, my experience, I'm really convinced that when committed Christians and committed Muslims get together, the one who is most active in the dialogue is the Holy Spirit. And sometimes you can really feel your hearts burning, like the people on the way to Emmaus. It's so clear that God is calling us to be deeper Christians, and I believe calling them to be deeper Muslims. And when I look back over the past 43 years now, it's been for me, in which I've spent most of my time, most of my energy, most of my days together with Muslims, I can see it as a real grace for me that through my encounters with Muslims, God has really made me a better Christian, a better Catholic, a better priest. And this gives me a lot of hope. Because if God has so powerfully used the encounter with Muslims to touch my life, I can be just as confident that God has used the encounter with me to touch the lives of many Muslims.
My thanks there to Jesuit Father Tom Michel, former official in charge of Islam at the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.